We'll call the Local Government Division Committee meeting to order. First bill on the agenda is Representative Markwart, House File 2894. And we do have a quorum, so thank you for getting over here quickly after session.
Question, Mr. Chair.
The chair's announced.
Yeah, we were scared.
I apologize for the brusqueness of it.
No.
The job done.
Representative Markwart, Representative Lanning moves House File 2894 to be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government. Welcome to the committee, Representative Markwart. Please proceed with presenting your bill. And
thank you very, very much, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing House File 2894, which I think is a very timely and pertinent bill. Just in the Red River Valley, for example, some new crest numbers came out, and they're looking at the Red River in Moorhead cresting at about 38 feet Friday or Saturday, and which is about 3 feet below the all-time record from last year, and then in Breckenridge Wahpeton about 17.5, which is about 2 feet under those numbers. Now, the Weather Service, and this is despite records amount of precipitation that we've had last fall into this winter and so forth, and expectations it would be much worse. And much of the reason is because of the unseasonably warm weather we've had the last week, but also part of it that helps keep levels down are the storage of water upstream and the impoundment projects that are done upstream. And the watershed districts, that is one of their main priorities, is to construct, plan, and maintain storage and impoundment projects and so forth. What we're looking to do here is to move the borrowing authority from $600,000 to $2 million. The reason for that is the value of land is going up. When a watershed district wants to do impoundment projects, it's crucial that they can get the land up front in a timely manner, and they need upfront dollars to do that before other dollars can help. The price of land have gone up 2 and 3 times in the last few years. To do a typical project of let's say 400 to 1,500 acres gets into the millions of dollars. So this would help the watershed districts pursue these projects in a more aggressive and timely fashion. I've got here Ron Harnick, who's the project manager for the Red River Watershed Management Board, and also Ray Bone, who's the administrator of the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts here, to also answer any questions. So, members, that's my bill, and would appreciate your support.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Harnick, project coordinator for the Red River Watershed Management Board. And as Representative Markwart indicated, the watershed districts are attempting to really be aggressive about water storage in the Red River Valley. It's one of the very key components to making the Red River Valley more flood resilient. We can only do so much by building structural measures. We have to do a lot more to be able to hold the water on the land where it falls and store it so that we can have a significant effect on reducing flood stages on the main stem. As Representative Markwart indicated, land values in the last several years have gone up significantly, fourfold in some cases, from as little as $925 to now $3,300 per acre. And our ability to be able to get land when it is available from willing sellers needs to take place in a very aggressive fashion, because if we don't get the land when it's available, it'll be sold off to somebody else, and we lose the opportunity to be able to get that land, and it will either delay the project or virtually result in it never taking place. The debt retirement for this comes through the existing capacity of the watershed districts. It will not raise the property taxes. There is no state costs. The Department of Revenue did issue a assessment of it and said that there is no state cost as a result of this. So we're really looking forward to having this additional authority sooner than later, because we have projects that are really in need of having this additional borrowing authority in order to proceed.
Thank you. I have one question here, and there's an amendment here. Is this your amendment, or?
Mr. Chair, that is not my amendment.
Okay. Because I know there's been talk here about the Red River Valley, and this amendment, I think, limits it to the Red River Valley. Is there a reason why, is there a good reason why we shouldn't put this on, or?
Mr. Chair, no. In fact, I think this should apply to all watershed districts around the state. And I know Mr. Ray Bone, if that amendment does come up, would speak in opposition to that.
Okay. Yep. Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, I did talk to Mr. Harnack and Mr. Bone, as well as the author, about whether we should consider limiting it to just one or two watersheds. And I'm convinced that there's enough watersheds in the state that are under, I can't remember if it's 103B or 103D, is the rural, the non-metro is D, and the 103B watersheds have the property tax base within the metro to do what they need to do. That I think that my concern was, would we be allowing watersheds to do more than they should fiscally? I'm convinced that they wouldn't, and that the harm to limiting, we could be, well, I won't be back here in 2 years, but someone could be back here in 2 years saying, whoops, we need to add these folks, or we need to add these folks. I think that it's a prudent step to keep the bill in the shape it is in, but I do think we should watch in general to make sure that we're making the right move here.
Thank you. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harnack, I think you said something, and I'm just trying to figure out how it can work. It said you can absorb this increased debt capacity and debt service capacity within all of your existing revenue flow. Tell me how that works.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastland. And I'll speak for the Red River Valley because I'm most familiar with those. Watershed districts have a certain base level levy authority currently, and it's capped at $250,000 per year. In addition, the Red River Watershed Management Board has an additional levy capacity that brings in $1 million to each one of the watershed districts annually. And that gets put in a construction fund that's used for projects. And this borrowing authority then would be paid off through that construction fund, through reimbursement from the Flood Damage Reduction Grant Program, and through cost share funds that the River Watershed Management Board brings back to the district. So in those cases, then, the watershed districts would have a sufficient capacity to be able to deal with the debt retirement, because they don't really have any other choices, because they have no capacity to raise their levies without additional legislative authority long term.
Representative Eastland.
Yeah, just one other question. So maybe this is just a irrelevant question, but are we to assume then that you are, everybody is levying the max, that there's no room in the levy that's places that are under levying now, and then in the future they're going to be increasing that levy? So in effect, there's an additional source of revenue that's coming in, that's additional taxes. I mean, I guess right. Where are you in your levy authority and what you're actually assessing right now?
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Eastland, I don't have those exact numbers in front of me. I think there are a few smaller districts statewide that are not levying that amount, but I couldn't name any right now that are not at their cap. Even the small districts are more limited by their percentage than they are by the $250,000.
Okay. Representative Eastman. Okay. Any further questions? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marquardt, I'm still a little puzzled about how this gets paid back, particularly when we're talking about flooding issues. I don't recall a time that we haven't had flooding issues in the Red River Valley. If we're going to borrow $2 million every year to deal with that, how does that get paid back?
Mr. Harnack, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty. Most of these dollars aren't to deal with the flooding as it occurs. It's to construct impoundments and water storage downstream to protect future flooding. So it's not related to every year's flooding. In fact, the more of these that we can do will actually hopefully prevent the nature of the flooding downstream. But if you want to know specifically, I guess, on how the dollars work on one of these projects, I'd let Mr. Harnack talk about that.
Mr. Harnack.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, I give one example. We have a project in the Wild Rice River Watershed District, and they bring in $250,000 from their general levy. They bring in an additional $400,000 per year for their construction fund from the Red River Watershed Management Board's levy. Through that, those two funds and the reimbursements for the project that can be up to 75% from the state's flood damage reduction program, they would then retire that borrowing capacity. So it's well within their ability through the current funds that they would see coming through the process, either Red River Watershed Management Board cost share, the flood damage reduction program, their construction levy, and their general fund levy would be able to provide for the debt retirement.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, also one clarification for Representative Hilty.
Representative Marquardt.
It is that $2 million is what they can have at any one time. It's not an annual appropriation. It's what they can ever have as a max on the books.
Representative Hilty.
And Mr. Chair, if I understood Mr. Harnack correctly, he described the $250,000 from the levy and the $450,000 from
$400,000.
The board, $400,000, which would amount to what is the current limit of $600,000. So I presume then that the excess of that, that you're counting on paying back, comes from I forget the term I'm trying to the flood reduction account.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative.
How is that financed?
Mr. Harnack.
The flood damage reduction program is bonding proceeds, and the bonding bill, like this year, has $63.5 million in it for flood damage reduction, and those are 50-50 up to 75% grants for flood damage reduction to communities, watershed districts statewide. If an individual watershed district, say, borrowed $1 million for a project, and they have a capacity to pay that off, even if it was with their own funds, at, say, $400,000 per year, it would take them 2.5 years to pay it off through their construction fund. But the way it would happen is that with some of the reimbursements or cost sharing from the state funds and cost sharing from the Red River Watershed Management Board, we feel that the individual watershed districts in the individual scenario that I represented would be able to pay off those within a year to 2 years without any additional levies or costs to anyone else.
Representative Hilty. Representative Lanning.
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support this bill. And you can't borrow any money unless you have a means to pay it back. And they have a means to pay this back. It may take a little bit longer in some cases, but they have the wherewithal to do that. And so this bill doesn't in any way raise anybody's tax levy or ability to raise revenue. It's revenue that they're already raising. And unless they have revenue sufficient to cover their debts, they're not going to get money borrowed to them.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. Any further questions? Testifiers? Anybody in the audience like to speak for or against the bill? If not, Representative Lanning renews his motion that House File 2894 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State, Local Government, Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much.
Next bill on the docket today is Representative Coonan's House File, excuse me, Senate File 2602. Welcome to the committee. And Representative Sterner moves that Senate File 2602 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. Representative Coonan, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Let me start first by saying, in current law, if land is acquired by condemnation and is not used for the purpose it was acquired, the landowner or the underlying fee owner may apply to the district court of the county where the land is located for an order discharging the easement. And then, of course, all interested parties are notified. What this bill does is allows for the fee owner to apply to district court for portions of the easement. In the old law, it had to be the whole easement. Now, that what the change is, it'll allow for a portion of the easement and that be discharged by the district court. And the court also does not apply to public service organizations, just to make that clear. But that's the one change it does. It allows for portions of easement to be discharged. And Mr. Chairman and committee members, I have with me today Mr. Dennis Larson, and he would like to talk to the committee a little bit about the purpose of this bill also.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dennis Larson from Montevideo, Minnesota. What this bill does is it puts some consistency in the law. And in just for an example, if, say, the state of Minnesota took 100 acres of land for highway purposes and only needed 10 acres of that land, the courts do not have jurisdiction right now. They can either rule to get rid of all of the easement or none of. And so, and I think the courts should be the one who have the final say in any matter. The person would still have to go through due process and prove to the courts that the land was not needed for the purpose it was initially taken. So there's nothing that changes there, but it gives the property owner the right to release the portion of the land that is not used for what it was initially taken for.
Any questions of the testifier? Anyone that would like to speak against the bill? Or for the bill? Please. Thank you again. Please identify yourself for the tape and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson, representing the League of Minnesota Cities. And I was able only briefly to talk to the author this afternoon. We had not noticed that this bill moved so quickly through the Senate until late last week. And so that's not his fault. That's our fault. So I apologize for the late notice on this, but we do have significant concerns with the unintended consequences of this legislation, not with any specific reason that was already mentioned here. I'll give you a very brief description of why. Trails are a good example of this. If you had to do a separate easement for trails, either for bike trails, pedestrian trails, whichever kind, the cost of those easements would far exceed what most communities have for budgets for park and rec trail development. Those are normally piggybacked on existing easements, and frequently those are transportation easements because they're the largest easements we have, and that allows the project to be affordable. What this would allow is someone who has one of those easements crossing their property could simply just say that is not the purpose this easement was originally taken for, and they could require that project be stopped simply because it crosses the easement through their property. And I know that's not the intent, but it is a potential unintended consequence, and really it's being done to have a more efficient way of where to site these types of projects. Rather than having new easements go through private property in new locations using existing easements, to cite these kinds of proposals. So I do not, I'm afraid, Mr. Chair, have a recommendation for how to fix this at the time. We simply would point out that while we understand there may be some specific concerns with how this has worked in the past, we think that simply throwing out all partial uses of easements in this manner could have a number of unintended consequences that we haven't had time to really look at yet.
Okay, Representative Biskens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. If you look, what we're talking about here, is condemnation of or acquiring an easement by condemnation. When you use condemnation, you have to say why you're condemning the land to acquire the easement. If that is stated, and now you can show that, they condemned my land and made the easement, and now they're not even using it for what it should be used for, then I think, as representatives of the people, that we should give the homeowners a reasonable right to challenge the easement. I'm not quite sure I understand the objection. If a city is condemning land, saying this is the purpose, and then they change the purpose and say, but we don't want to give you the right to, contest this, even though we changed the purpose, well, I think that's not representing our citizens real well.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, that certainly could still be adjudicated, but the idea being that, and of course the city could certainly claim that putting a pedestrian and bike lane in an existing transportation easement is a valid transportation purpose, but we think it's opening up a tremendous amount of conflict in a place where right now it's pretty clear that if you have an existing easement and you can safely add that kind of use within that easement in some manner, that it can be done, and this would create doubt as to that and potential legal challenges. We have not had opportunity to look at other places where this applies, but we do know that most of the times where our cities are citing trails, they try to piggyback on existing easements where they can, or frankly there's not enough money in the trails budgets to be able to afford to add them.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Larson.
This change is not out to take away the 75-foot easement that a state highway has. If bike trails are to be put in the easement, this has nothing to do with that. We're talking about the land outside of the 75-foot from the center line easement. If bike trails need to go in, this bill does not change that. But I agree with the senator, and I'm sorry I can't see his name.
Representative.
Representative.
Biskens.
If land is taken, it should be used for the purpose it was taken and not just left open to build toilets on or to build anything else on it as there has been in the past. So if a bike trail is needed, the landowner, again, still has to go through due process in the system to prove to the court that the land isn't needed. And at that time, anyone that objects to that can still object.
Representative Biskens, follow-up? Or no. Representative Eastland.
Yeah, I think you kind of answered my question. I guess I was just thinking of some other possibilities that could occur. That if there was a bike trail or a walking trail that was put in and development kind of changed or something, and it didn't turn out and wasn't needed, didn't use, and all of a sudden they wanted to change the use and make it a snowmobile trail. What would have to happen? I mean, that kind of a change would have a significant impact on landowners and on neighbors and everything else. It would seem like they're like what we're seeing here. We could just simply say that they couldn't do that. What you're saying is that you'd like them to be able to do that.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair and members, it would very much depend on the specifics of any individual case, but what we would normally see, for instance, with a trail going through a city, is we would use some existing rights of way and some through parks, some through other types of rights of way. Obviously, abandoned rail rights of way are frequently used for trails where we have access to them. There's a lot of different places where we use this, and I don't know how it would affect any one given use. I do know that anytime you're adding a new use, there are public opportunities there to object to that kind of project going forward, and especially if there's public money involved, there are numerous hearings about how that money will be spent and what projects will be approved. So it would definitely not be automatic that a change could just be made to the use of a property.
Representative Eastland.
Okay, and I guess, so my question then would be is, does this bill then actually move us in the direction so that you could not use that, or is this just putting the trump card back in the hand of the landowner rather than the public entity?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know if it's putting a trump card back in the hand necessarily, but it definitely would make it so that we would be far more controlled by the landowner's decisions on how they'd like to see those easements used. An example, we recently discussed utility easements, and I believe this committee actually added some language to require that, or the Energy Committee did, one of the two, to require that high-voltage transmission lines and other types of utility easements be sited within existing rights-of-way, if at all possible. And we included transportation rights-of-way on that list. Well, this would say that if that was not one of the initial purposes of that, that even though we just said it's the state's preference that that's where those types of projects should be sited, a potential landowner could now say, but that's not what I want, so you can't put it here, and then we're back right where we are now fighting about whose field has the and whose subdivision has the line running through it.
Representative Eastland.
Okay, yeah, and I think I understand, and I guess what I'm hearing you say is that it's basically right now, if you go back to the negotiating table, that the public entity has more control over the outcome than the landowner, that there's a lot of obligation put on the landowner to really resist a change in use. And what this bill does is it simply says that, well, it puts that burden onto the public entity. I'm not sure that that's a bad thing, and so I guess I'm inclined to like his bill and think that it's probably the direction, as a private landowner myself, that I would like to be treated in a way that if all of a sudden the rules changed about how the property that was taken was going to be used, I'd like to at least know that and have something to say about the outcome of that. So I think it doesn't seem to me that it seems to me that it's workable either way. Currently it puts a lot more onerous responsibility on the landowner, and this maybe is a fairer way to do it.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coonan or Mr. Johnson or Larson, one of the things I'm having trouble getting my head around here is that current law provides that you can apply for the dischargement of an easement if it's the whole thing. In a case where, for instance, you have a easement for highway right-of-way, there wouldn't be any question about whether, if the highway still exists, there wouldn't be any question about whether some of the easement wasn't being used. So I don't see why having an additional use on there could, I mean, it's still being used for the purpose for which it was granted in the first place. It's just sort of on top of that you would have a trail, say. So I don't see how you could discharge a portion of the highway right-of-way claiming that it wasn't being used when it is being used for the highway. Am I missing something?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, this isn't for the purpose of taking away the 75 feet of highway. This is for the purpose of taking the other 90 acres back that's not being used. This is not at all, in fact, you wouldn't be able to do that. The state has the right to 75 feet on either side to build a highway. This isn't for that. This is for the other 90 acres that is not being used, and the farmer wants to put in corn or put up a housing development.
Representative Hilty.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that was sort of my point, but...
Any further questions of the testifiers? If not, thank you. Representative Coonan, if you want to wrap up and closing words or
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. The League of Minnesota Cities just approached me about their concern just a couple hours ago, and so that this is all kind of new to me. To be honest with you, I didn't even realize they could use condemnation for a purpose of a road and then make part of that condemnation available for another use other than the road. I didn't know there was that much leeway in the statute. That's somewhat surprising to me. In this country, land ownership is one of the fundamental rights we have, and I think that if political subdivisions are going to use this process, that it needs to be to the point and for a specific use. To go forward with this in a district court and say that the land, that all of the land in this that this easement applies to is to be used for a purpose of a road, let's say, for example, and then part of it is all of a sudden changed to another purpose, that makes me a little bit nervous. I do think that if a city or a county or whoever wants to come back and use that land for a different purpose, then maybe it should go to court, to the district court again. I realize what Mr. Johnson said, there's extra cost, but again, I'm going to go back to my original statement that in this land, in this country, owning land is a fundamental right, and I think that needs to be protected too as much as possible. But other than that, committee members, I ask for your support on the bill.
Can you get anybody that would like to speak additionally for or against the bill? If not, Representative Stirner renews his motion that Senate File 2602 be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Coonan, you might as well stay there. Okay. The next bill is House File 3327, Representative Coonan's. And again, Representative Stirner moves that House File 3327 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. The current law requires that cities and counties of more than 15,000 in population annually notify its residents of the positions and base salaries of its three highest paid employees. What this bill does is add language to statute, and that would be 471.701, so that the language would not apply to employees of a city-owned or county-owned hospital. And today, Mr. Chairman, I have Mr. Glenn Haugo, the administrator at Renville County Hospital, here to talk to the bill.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Mr. Haugo.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Glenn Haugo. I'm the administrator of Renville County Hospital in Olivia. And currently, Minnesota state law requires that cities and counties with a population of greater than 15,000 are required each year to publish their three highest salaries, either for 90 days on their website, on their tax bills, or on a newsletter of general circulation to taxpayers. The bill eliminates city or county-owned hospitals. There are seven of those currently in the state. City or county-owned hospitals in city or counties greater than 15,000 population. Those would be Douglas County Hospital, Meeker County, Hennepin County, Kennebec County, Renville County, and then the city-owned hospitals in Northfield and Wilmer. And the reasoning behind this is that the original intent of the bill was that if a disgruntled taxpayer wanted to know what the salaries were of the three highest paid people in either the courthouse or City Hall, that would be available to them and published. In the case of the hospitals, and I'll speak of ours, we don't use any property tax money. Our fees are entirely user-generated. And when we hire doctors, and that's the issue here, when we hire doctors and we have contracts and they're on production-based, there's no tax money, no property tax money that goes into that. And it creates a little bit of difficulty for us in that not everybody gets paid the same and because of different production. And so that can create some issues. And also we have to compete with our neighbors who are also hiring doctors, and what we're paying each other is kind of makes it difficult. It's something we want to keep confidential because we are a business that depends on a bottom line. When we hire physicians, we have to pay market price, and we have to pay enough to hire the physicians, but not so much that it damages our bottom line. We've got to right price it because we're a business in a competitive industry.
Thank you. Is there any questions for the testifier? Representative Coonan, there's a amendment here. Is this your amendment or?
No, it is not.
Is there anybody that wishes to offer the amendment? Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, I think that as I understand the amendment, I think it gets to the point. And so I think for the purpose of the sort of balances the original intent of the law, and I think for the purposes of discussion, at least, I'll move the DE1 amendment.
Representative Kalin moves the DE, the 3327 DE1 amendment. Representative Kalin.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, if I remember right, you know, one of the concerns, I think there's a concern about transparency, both at the hospital level as well as at the basic city and county level. And so I think that you know, I don't have strong feelings, but I think that we should think about making sure that we get both pieces of it. And I think for sort of good government transparency, it might be something we want to consider is catching the not only the hospital employees, but also the non-hospital employees. I think this accomplishes it. I don't have strong feelings, but I'm going to vote for the amendment. I'm open to discussion from the committee.
Representative Biskins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I tend to support the amendment. My question, and maybe to the testifier, said that hospitals that he's aware of are totally fee-based, and so I guess I'm wondering, is it the testimony here in this committee that a city-owned or a county-owned hospital does not receive taxpayer dollars either through city levy, county levy, or state tax appropriations? I guess that's the confusion I have right now.
Mr. Hugel.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm not aware that any do. We don't. We have no property tax money that comes in, and I'm not aware of any of the others either. We all do have employed physicians, however, except for Meeker County, whose physicians are from private clinics.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I'm still confused, and I'm going to support the amendment, and the reason I'm going to support the amendment at this time is because it doesn't seem like we've got good enough information to find out is there general fund revenues from either city, county, or state. If there isn't, and this moves on to Chair Pawlowski's committee, all right, then I will make the motion to amend to get it back into this shape. All right, but I do think because we don't want an amendment like this in Chair Pawlowski's committee and not having good enough information, that it might be prudent of us to put it on here, all right, and then research it in between the two stops.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my thinking was going kind of down the same lines, and I guess what I'm wondering is, are we separating, operating costs from capital costs? I mean, if it says it's a city or county owned, and they own and operate a public hospital, I mean, who owns the building? Who paid for the building? If there's, I guess that's kind of my questions here. I mean, just paying for the operations is one piece of the financial puzzle, but I mean, you're also in a facility that somehow got there, and I'm assuming that if it's owned by the city or the county, that they were probably taxpayers' dollars that purchased or built that building. I don't know, but I mean, just
Representative, but Mr. Chair. In our case, no, there wasn't. The hospital was built back in the 50s. There was a Hilburton Act grant and a private association that built the hospital, and ownership was turned over to the county in the 70s. So there's never been any local tax money that has gone into that. And it's always been self-supporting through user fees. We have a separate board. We have a separate payroll. And our local county uses that so that the three top paid courthouse employees don't have to publish, you know, that doesn't have to be published. Our three highest paid docs substitute for that.
Mr. Chair, again.
Representative Eastland.
Yeah, and I guess that I really concur with Representative Biskins then on this, that I mean, and I think that there could be some clarification language that would limit this proposal to hospitals that are similar to what you're talking about, so that it's very clear that there are no public dollars going in here. I'm sure that's not the case. I mean, I shouldn't say I'm sure, but I would think that's probably not the case for every hospital that exists that it's city-owned or operated. And so I think maybe that could be the criteria that's used, that there would be some mechanism for determining that it is self-sufficient and it does not involve use of public dollars.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the intent of the amendment, Representative Kalin?
Representative Kalin.
The provision in lines 111 and beyond, does this still mean 15,000, or is it any city or county that owns and operates?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I think Ms. Dyson may be the best one to ask.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, that's a good question. If it's intended to be limited to city or county with a population of more than 15,000, it probably should be inserted to make that clear.
Representative Lanning.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's maybe an issue here that needs to be debated, but I think we're mixing apples and oranges here. it seems to me that Representative Conan's bill is straightforward in 3327, and if somebody wants to have legislation that directs a policy for any city or county-owned hospital, that ought to be a separate provision and not mixing the two together here in this amendment.
Mr. Haugen, I would question I thought I heard you say this, that the intent of this is so that, I mean, currently you're saying right now that the three highest paid people in your county are the three highest paid doctors in your hospital, and that's why this is coming forward, because you want this to get at the original intent of what this, the original statute goes at, or am I reading that wrong?
No, that's correct, Mr. Chairman. My intent is not to have to publish my three highest physician salaries, because they don't know what each other make. They're competitive. There's no reason to get that out there. Our county I did not give them, refused to give them our physician contract information. And on the website, they published a little notice that said this includes only, you know, courthouse employees, does not include the hospital employees. And if you want to know that, call Glenn Halgo at and gave my phone number. And during the year, I'll tell you how many phone calls I had, zero. That's, you know, when somebody's upset with their tax bill, they don't care what the hospital employees, the physicians are making, because they understand the mechanism of that. I think the intent was originally that if they're upset with a tax bill and they want to know what people in City Hall or the courthouse are making, that gave them a easy way to do that. They can get it from us or for anyone else just by calling if they want to know, but at least it's not published on a, you know, public document that is available to all the taxpayers.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, it doesn't necessarily have to be a disgruntled taxpayer. It could be just somebody looking to get information. And so I guess I'd shy away from that a little bit. You know, members of this committee, there are other city employees whose pay is entirely fee-based. I wastewater treatment facilities within a city. Entirely fee-based, and yet they are employees of the city, and they're subject to this law. I guess I do have a question, whether or not they are quote-unquote entirely fee-based. If they are city or county-owned facilities, are they paying property taxes? Are they paying corporate income taxes at the same level of other private businesses, or are they receiving some kind of tax breaks, which I would think would be appropriate if they are city or county owned. So in some way, shape, or form, there is taxpayer subsidies. Now, you can argue that this is a competitive market. Well, other people will argue that hiring a city administrator is an awful darn competitive market. In the city of Jordan, we lose quality city administrators every 4 or 5 years to our suburban friends next step in, because they've got a higher tax base and they can afford to pay them a little more. That's just part of the gig. It's part of the game. So I think what the intent of this law is a very good one. It is transparency and openness. If they are indeed public employees, which it sounds like they are, then part of this transparency and following the taxpayer money is the publication thereof, their salaries.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I heard the testifier say was that there were no property taxes and no local taxes. And then what I heard Representative Eastland say was public taxes. I'm assuming that there's state taxes that go to this hospital. And as Representative Biskins mentioned, they're subsidies of sorts. So we're talking about taxpayer dollars no matter where they come from. It's a taxpayer-supported subsidy or the state from the Human Services Department or whatnot. So I think that should be clarified. I only heard the testifier say no property taxes and no local taxes.
Mr. Halgren.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scalzi, I was careful not to say no taxes, because like all hospitals, we certainly have Medicare and Medicaid, but that comes in fee-based. My issue that's different in terms of the other representative talking about fee-based employees with a wastewater treatment plant or something like that, all of our customers have a choice. They can go to within 30 miles of our facility. There are, well, let's say within 40 miles of our facility, there are about five other hospitals that they have a choice to go to. And we have to, you know, if you have a road department or a wastewater treatment plant in your city or something else, that's it. You have no choice of any other service to use. With our hospitals, we have to be competitive, and we have to provide the best service that we can in order that people come in our door. If they don't like our service, if it's not priced right, if our overhead is improper, our fixed or operating costs don't, you know, if it all doesn't come together, they're going to go somewhere else.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I wanted to talk about your board for a moment, and I don't know if this is directly to the
amendment as much as it is just to speak in support of the bill. And it may need to be, let me just talk about the board. You mentioned, Mr. Haugo, that you have a board that oversees your hospital, I assume, and this is a question to you. Tell us how your board's constituted, who's on it, and to whom they're accountable.
Mr. Haugo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We have a board. In prior years, our county commission also served a dual role as our hospital board. They went to separate meetings, had a separate hospital meeting, and had a county meeting. 2 years ago, the board was changed. There are now two county commissioners on the board. One of them has to serve as the chairman, and then there are five other members that are appointed by the county commission.
From the
representative Beard.
From the population at
from
large?
From the general population.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Beard.
Serving on a hospital foundation in Shakopee where it's not owned by the city or the county, but it's owned by three separate entities, including the Benedictine nuns. We have a board, too, that's accountable to the larger citizenry. And although we don't necessarily take out an ad in the paper and publish the salaries of our administrators and the top folks at the hospital, there are people who are accountable to the community who know those numbers. And I guess that's the point I'm trying to make here. And just members, as this bill moves forward, I'm thinking that this might be part of the answer to the deal. Obviously, we would like the taxpayers to know how much they're paying their city administrator, their county administrator, the county attorney, the city attorney, whatever. But in this case, it's a hospital, and I know how dreadfully difficult it is to get good talent to stay in rural hospitals in the first place. And if we are going to try to induce a doctor of some sort to come out and be the head of pediatrics in your hospital, and oh, by the way, we have to publish your salary in the paper if you take the job, we can see where that would have a dampening effect. And so I'm going to say that we probably have the mechanisms in play already for that citizen accountability. If you have a citizen board that is accountable to people, and if inquiring minds want to know, they can ask.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly can happen, it sounds like. So I'm suggesting we probably really don't have much of a problem here, except that the language, as it's written in the bill, would make it appear that we are required in a community-owned hospital to publish those things. Maybe Representative Conan's bill actually is a step in the right direction to help making your job a little easier to attract talent to your hospitals, knowing that there still is a citizen board in play that is the defense mechanism for the taxpayers. Thanks.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess after Representative Biskin's last comment, I'm not sure I agree with him totally. But I think I understand the need for being competitive and having a certain amount of ability not to publish. My assumption would be that most of the information would be public information if people requested it, but it just is not going to be published. Is that true? And I think the intent here is I think reasonable. I guess my concern is that there should just be some little tightening up language that would put some kind of requirement in here, so that if there's a public board, another board that oversees this, or something that would at least ensure that we aren't applying this to hospitals that maybe aren't operating like yours and are using some public taxpayer dollars to actually function. And as far as not paying property tax, most nonprofits pay no property tax. Most hospitals are organized that way as well. So most hospitals don't pay property tax. I think that we're close to something that could work here. But I'd like to see something that would at least make a little bit of clarification, so we're sure that there isn't a subsidy of property taxpayers are paying to keep this thing going.
Any further questions? Looks like everyone's ready to vote. On the amendment. Representative Kalin renews his motion for the DE1 amendment. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. On the original bill, Representative Sterner renews his motion that House File 3327 be recommended to pass and return to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All in favor of the bill, please say aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee.
The next bill on the committee is House File 3350, Representative Smith. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Eastland moves that House File 3350 be recommended to pass and to be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government. Please explain your bill. And
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Excuse me, and members, I have with me tonight a council member from the city of Mound, which, to refresh your memory, is a community on the west end of Hennepin County, a couple miles from the county line, population approximately 9,700. The mayor presented this bill in the Senate last Thursday or Friday. What it would do, Mr. Chairman, is that it would prohibit full-time permanent city employees from serving on the city council in that city, becoming effective August 1, 2010, so it would be prospective. Similar prohibitions already exist in Minnesota that prevent, for example, school district employees from serving on the district school board, and another example is preventing county employees from serving as county commissioners. And with that, I'm going to let Councilman Osmick explain the need for this provision.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is David Osmick. I am a city councilman of the city of Mound. I'm in my ninth year serving the community as a city council member. As Representative Smith indicated, this is not a groundbreaking type of episode. This is actually making city councils reflective of the same rules that are governed by school boards and county boards, in that full-time employees are not eligible to be on those respective governing bodies. In 2006, when this actually did occur, the election completed and a city employee was elected by 15 votes, a request was made to the Attorney General's office for an opinion as to a compatibility issue. The Attorney General's office actually submitted back the request, saying that our city attorney should be doing the investigation on it, at which point it was deemed that there was not a compatibility issue. Subsequent to his taking the seat, this particular individual's taking the seat on the council, there were two particular episodes that I'd like to bring to your attention. One, and they very much bring into question whether a city employee should be sitting on the governing body by which he derives his full-time employment. The first one is regarding a water meter issue. We were replacing water meters throughout our entire city. And there are the water meters. Some of the individuals within our city did not want these water meters put inside of their houses. They preferred to have them in the exterior. The city employee, who is the Department of Streets, Water, and Sewers superintendent, actually did not provide information to the council to make an accurate decision. The specifications, he indicated, were that the water meters had to be put interior to every household. When it was further researched out by the mayor, it was determined, according to the specifications of the manufacturer, they would exist outside in rain up to a negative 30 degree temperature. So in this case, the employee used his position to withhold information from the council that they could actually accurately make a policy decision affecting the entire community. Another example of this has to do with the setting of salaries. In our community, the union contracts set the rates for the administrative code, and he is governed by the administrative code. This individual actually forced himself, against the city attorney's opinion, into a closed meeting where there were discussions regarding these union contracts. So while we did do everything by the book, we did go to the attorney general, we did the legal opinion regarding the compatibility of issue, or a compatibility of office issue, it continues to spring up. And to be perfectly honest, I really don't think any additional communities should be subject to these types of problems. And they are ongoing problems. This does not affect part-time employees. And in smaller communities in Minnesota, part-time employees could be firemen, volunteer firemen, who want to serve on the city council. This would not have any effect on those individuals. To this day, people still in my community question the conflict of interest and the continuing conflicts of a full-time person who actually administers staff and directs staff being on the city council, and it really reduces our ability to govern. It is questioned whether this is the decisions the council is making are accurate and unbiased. It also raises the question of our city manager form of government that we actually live underneath. Our city manager has her subordinate and her council member, and she's in the middle, and she has specifically expressed great concern over the conflicts that happen from time to time of the city manager essentially being caught in the middle and not knowing who she's talking to, if she's talking to one of her subordinates or if she's talking to a city council member. And with that, I'd be happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could have a moment.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, just one additional piece of testimony.
Representative Smith.
The case that I brought to your attention with the union contracts, Mr. Representative Smith wanted me to maybe illustrate or provide more light into that one. The way our city administrative code is set up is that our three union contracts, the average in our city administrative code of our city union contracts, are what sets our administrative code. So if we set a cost of living increase for our three unions at 3% on an average, the city the administrative code would set a 3% increase for all non-union administrative staff. This particular individual, who is the city employee on the city council, is subject to the administrative code. By him being inside of these closed negotiations against the city attorney's specific recommendation, he in effect participated in the setting of his own salary. It was one union, but one union sets in motion the other two unions and sets in motion the administrative code. So in effect, what he is doing is setting his own salary or increasing his own salary based on the fact that he legally, we could not stop him. He was advised not to go into the closed-door meeting, but he decided to go against city attorney, which, frankly, I guess any city council member can ignore their city attorney at their own peril. But he, in effect, in that case, actually participated in the setting of a salary.
Okay. Mr. Osmond, I have one question that I want to clear my mind here. Now, if this bill passes as it's written, does the city employee council person, would they then have to choose between whether they want to be on the council, or is this going forward after the next election or going forward after this person steps down?
Mr. Chairman, this would only be in effect as of August 1st for any election subsequent to August 1st, 2010. Not only is this true, but also my understanding is the gentleman on my council is actually going to be retiring from his public employee service job. So that from my perspective, this is not actually going to be dealing with my city council at all. He's going to be retiring, and the conflict is obviously no longer going to be there. But I feel very, very strongly that no other city in Minnesota should be subject to the types of dual loyalties that actually are occurring under this current situation.
So, Mr. Chairman, the answer is yes, it's prospective, would not affect his current position.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Smith. Any more questions? Representative Piskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick question. Representative Smith, why not the mayor? Why only city council members?
Mr. Chairman, Smith. Representative Piskins, restate.
Representative Piskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, the piece of legislation we have in front of us deals only with city council members. You're silent on the mayor. So if this were to move forward, it would appear to me that the mayor, you could still run for mayor and be a city employee. And maybe Ms. Dyson could correct me. And I didn't know, Representative Smith, if that was your intent or not.
Representative Smith. Mr. Hosmick.
I can respond to that. What the way this is written, it says city council member, not city council member. The mayor is a member of the city council. So this would, in my interpretation, impact the mayor as it would be other members of the city council because it says city council member with a space.
Ms. Dyson, is that how you read that also, or would the mayor be exempt?
Mr. Chair, I think it depends on the form of city government. I think there are some cities where the mayor is not a member of the city council. The mayor is the executive branch, and I should know this. I live in St. Paul, but St. Paul's mayor is not a member of the city council, and I don't think Minneapolis is either. And the first section of the bill does apply to city charter or home rule charter cities. So I think there are two parts to the answer to this question. The bill specifically doesn't deal with that situation, but in the common law test, it should exclude the mayor being an employee, but obviously that didn't happen in Mound, where the common law test didn't work. So I think if you want to be specific and exclude the mayor, I think you should state so.
Representative Bissman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Smith, as you move through to the next committee, you might want to do that, because as I look at the statute that is first referenced, the 410.19, in that section, the mayor and council members are clearly separated. And so that's what drew my attention to it in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Thank you.
Representative Smith. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, you give us a lot of examples of cases that or things that were occurring in your particular example. Do we have any data about how many, if we went across and looked across the state of Minnesota, how many cities or had members of their council that were elected that were actually employees of the city?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, I cannot give you a complete, precise answer, excuse me, but I have been reviewing a document for part of our time on the floor when others were chatting away, that is an interesting document dated October 2005, a revision by Deborah McKnight, legislative analyst, and it has several citations beginning on a page 6 running all the way through page 14 of various attorney general opinions, very little legislation, but some. So apparently there have been examples, requests from cities with these kinds of problems, and then as was referenced, there is a common law test dealing with supervising or evaluating, and then ultimately the legislature, if it isn't clear or they choose to go this route, can pursue legislation. So I don't have a number for you, but it has come up periodically.
Mr. Osmeckle.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, I can name off the top of my head three separate examples of them. One is in the city of Champlin.
You don't have to get specific.
I can name three of them. There's a South Metro, and there's actually one in the Iron Range, because in the Senate committee, which I believe there was only one dissenting vote, the dissenter was Senator Lowry, and Senator Lowry indicated that they have a community that has this situation right now. But because the legislation is set up for elections after August 1st, you would not be throwing people out of office.
Representative Eastland.
Yeah, and I was just kind of curious if you had that kind of data. But this is reasonable, I think, to me. I guess I'm familiar with a number of cases where not in cities, for example, but for in school districts and counties and so on, where retired teachers or retired employees have run and gotten elected, and usually it's because they've had an issue and it's been very, very difficult. So I mean, it would even be more difficult if the person was a current employer. And I think there's a good reason why school districts and counties don't do it, and it seems like a reasonable approach here.
Representative Stirner.
I just had a question for Ms. Dyson, just regarding what other employment restrictions are there for elected officials currently and for the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Stirner, as Representative Smith pointed to, There is a publication from the House Research Department that has a table of all of the different types of situations that have been either through the Attorney General's opinion or statute positions that have been ruled either compatible, incompatible. Some examples for city council member, the city assessor for the same city is incompatible with being a city council member. The county assessor in the same county is incompatible with city council member. The county attorney, the county auditor, county commissioner, those are all incompatible, but you can be a county treasurer and a member of the city council. That's compatible.
Okay.
So it goes through, there's quite a list, and but there is always that fallback of the common law test, and I think if you have the bill summary in front of you, it explains that if there are two parts to this test. One is if you're hiring, supervising, or evaluates, or sets the salary for the other, or if it's occupying two offices is likely to result in occasions where the individual must harm or neglect one position in order to perform duties that are part of the other position. Okay. That's what a court would look at in evaluating whether positions are compatible. I just there was one in I wanted to just mention that on the issue of the mayor and working that through, I know that a lot of small cities with municipal liquor stores, the mayor is also employed by the muni, and that might be something you'd want to keep in mind if you wanted to add the mayor to an incompatible position of employee. That I know that there would be a lot of small cities affected by that. But
right. Thank you.
Representative Sterner.
Yep. And I just was going to add that the mayor is also usually the weed inspector for the city as well. Probably an unpaid, though.
But that's in statute.
Okay. All right.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I been wondering, I think, as happens on this committee, sort of thinking through the local government forms that we know from our communities. I'm always surprised in my short time here, that how different they are around the state, and that even representing a city of 10,000 and then a city of, I think, Center City is 313 or something like that. Now I know I'm going to get like six emails saying I don't know the population of my wonderful small city of Center City, but representing nine cities, even those are so different. And I mean, I appreciate the concern. I think that Mr. Osmick is bringing forward, but I do have caution that the elections that people vote generally knowing who they're putting on the council. And that the elections do have a great deal of accountability and transparency. And I'm wondering if, in the spirit of service, that somebody may be forced to quit their job. And I think that we can certainly recuse ourselves. I know it happens here in the House. I've actually recused myself from a couple of votes over my 4 years. I know I hear your frustrations, Mr. Osmond. I do with another council member, but I wanted to be fair to Representative Smith to express my caution where I think I need to know more before I can support the bill. But I do very much appreciate the initial concern. I just feel like it may not be ripe to become law yet.
Mr. Osmond.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one comment on that is that one of the biggest issues I have is that the impact to the other members of the council is just as important as it is the impact to the community. And that if this individual is able to withhold or add or provide or not provide information, it directly impacts my ability as a city councilman who's completely not causing the issue to be able to provide my governance for my city.
Representative Kalin.
To that point, Mr. Chair, Mr. Osmick, I share your frustration because the voters of Minnesota and their infinite wisdom. I share your frustration because the voters of Minnesota and their infinite wisdom gave us Governor Pawlenty and DFL majorities big enough to override in the Senate, not big enough to override in the House, and so I think our Republican colleagues are frustrated with us. We get frustrated with them, and in the end, we have to figure out a way to get things done. I share your frustration, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
Any further questions of the testifier? Anyone else would like to speak for or against this bill? If not, Representative Eastland renews his motion that House File 3350 be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Chairs in doubt. All in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? And chair votes aye. 5-3. 5-3. Most ayes have it. The motion prevails. Bill's passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Thank you.
Next bill on the day is Representative Bunn, House File 3392. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And as well as moving the bill, if you could move the amendment to put it in the form the author would like to discuss, I appreciate that.
Okay, Representative, do we have the amendment? Okay, Representative Sterner moves that House File 3392 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. And Representative Sterner moves House H3392A1. Is that the amendment?
Correct.
The A1 amendment. Representative Sterner.
He's here.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I thought he was here. I'm going.
He's here.
All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passed. Please explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As amended, real quickly for you to see, the original bill had four sections. We have just deleted sections 1 and 2. So we are only focusing on sections 3 and 4 of the bill, and so they are at the bottom of the page of the bill, starting at 1.20. Mr. Chair, this bill is being brought to you because of a series of events that has occurred over time in my county, Washington County, and the East Metro. Basically, over time, the county, because of the difficult budget challenges we've been facing this past decade, has gradually eroded away at the extension funding, the county share of extension funding in our county. First, with the Master Gardeners program, which has been eliminated entirely, and then more recent, in the last 2 years, scaling back funding of the 4-H program to the point where they had planned to do down to zero funding, but more recently have reinstated, at least for this last year, $30,000 funding, but with no commitment to go forward with additional funding. This is a very dire situation for the citizens of our county. We have a very extensive and active 4-H program. It's a very vital to have the existence of 4-H program to support our county fair and certainly on up to the state fair. The advocates in this area would have preferred something along the lines of just a county mandate and are requiring them that they support a certain level of extension cost sharing. Given the state of our budget, and particularly with my perspective from Health and Human Services, are continuing to cut counties more and more, it's our effort to try to relieve some mandates during this kind of period rather than add other ones. So given that, although there might be longer term funding discussions both with the extension overall in the state and also continuing with the county in that regard to have stable funding, and we hope to reinstate the county support as well. But given the current situation, what we were looking for here was ways to identify some flexibility for 4-H to go out and seek additional funding on its own. 4-H to exist, or any extension program to exist, has to have at least one half-time staff person. The state extension program won't certify the program without at least that person, so it can't be run entirely with volunteers. So this is why some source of funding for a staff person, at least a half-staff person, is required. So what we did in a series of meetings, first in the county and in the district, and then more recently this fall over the interim, we held here at the Capitol, bringing all the stakeholders in, bringing some people from county fair boards in, bringing the head of Dean of Extension in, is to just brainstorm lots of different different ideas to both long-term and shorter-term how we might help address this situation. What you have before us in these four ideas, now reduced to two, was a subset of about four of eight or nine ideas we explored, the four that seemed to be feasible during this year to address and have a discussion about, and that's what we came forward with. Specifically, the two components here in front of you are, number one, to allow townships or municipalities to contribute to 4-H if they so desired, just permissive language. Currently, while there's no law against doing this, there is an AG's opinion from 1941, which our city councils and others refer to in suggesting they are not able to do this. So we're putting clarifying language in the law that they are. And again, my testifiers will expand on that a little bit more. And finally, in Section 4, currently programs can charge various kinds of activities fees under 4-H, but it's not clear in law that they can also charge a participant fee. Some may be doing this already, but our reading of the law is they really weren't supposed to, so we want to make it clear that they can going forward. So those are the two small changes just to allow some flexibility, and I'd like to have my testifiers kind of tell a little more detail on that, why this particular type of flexibility is desired for them.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Olson. I'm an executive director of the Washington County Ag Society, and we are the board that puts together and has the Washington County Fair every year. Last year, about halfway through the cycle, the Washington County Commissioners decided to overturn the Extension Committee's funding request and eliminate all funding. We knew budget cuts were coming. We were expecting a 20 or a 30% cut. We weren't expecting 100. That threw us in a tailspin here, especially at the fair. We look at the fair is a major vehicle for 4-H, and 4-H is a major vehicle for us at the county fairs. We have 12 buildings on the fair. Eight of the 12 buildings are filled with 4-H exhibits. And it's a lot of the exhibits that families come to the fair for, the animals, the demonstrations, the food. It's a core part of our fair. And in exchange, the fair board, we give the 4-H program free use of the buildings throughout the year for their meetings, their exhibits, their preparations for the fair. During the discussions of eliminating the funding for 4-H, a number of cities in Washington County sent strong resolutions to the county commissioners stating that 4-H was a very important part of the county fabric, was very important to small businesses and the youth in their cities, and that we needed to put some effort forth into keeping 4-H and the fair alive. Our county commissioners came back and said, well, if it's so important to you, then you fund it. Being good men that the city are from the cities, they did go back. They did allocate funds, but they did find the Attorney General's opinion that the cities should not be giving funds to the 4-H organization. So that's one of our concerns. Julie has been very helpful in trying to get this through. It's not a great deal of money. The cities are. As few as a few hundred dollars to maybe $1,000 or more for donations. They're not going to be a complete replacement for our funding, but it would be a helpful to our funding and take some of the strain off of our youth that are really struggling to try and raise the amount of funds that are necessary to keep their program alive.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, we'll stop with that, and our other testifier will participate if there are questions. Otherwise, we'll stop at that point to address your issues and questions.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself. He's not going
to. I mean, he'll just be here for questions.
Okay.
As well.
Here for questions. Okay. Any questions of the testifier? Any questions about the bill?
No.
Anyone else? Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as I look at page 2, lines 1 through 4, I'm a little perplexed. Representative Bunn. Now, I'm not sure if I'm reading this correctly, mm-hmm. but it almost appears to me, because we're mandating the extension service of the University of Minnesota, we're mandating that they have to adopt a policy authorizing the fees to be used for the cost of a 4-H educator, are we not mandating that every 4-H program must impose participant fees? Is that your intent, Representative Bunn?
Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Buskins, that was not my intent. My intent that if they did adopt these fees, that they would be used for this purpose, for the participant fees. So you're reading it as that they shall adopt a policy and collect these fees. We were intending this to be as a permissive language. Currently, they all understand they can collect activities fees, but not necessarily like a membership to be involved or participant fee up front. That's for general use for staffing as opposed to the arts and crafts materials or the hay for the, or something specific to some of the activities they're involved in. That it was specific would be for the staff support.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess we would want to get counsel on that because, as I read it, I'm not sure. But again, it's been a long day, you know. And if I look at this participant fee, and if it is the cost of providing a 4-H educator, and the testimony was that it had to be at least half time, so I'm ballparking that at about $25,000. You have 100 4-Hers within your county, and you're now talking about a mandated $250 participant fee per 4-Her, and that's pretty steep. So I guess whether or not we're mandating this policy, and then by de facto its imposition, I think we need to be very careful.
Representative Biden.
Mr. Chair, and again, if there is lack of clarity, I'd be glad to work after this committee hearing is going other places to clear that up. But I interpret, maybe Ms. Dyson can address this, the word authorizing, that it's not just they shall do it, they shall be authorized to do it, meaning that they, and the word authorizing suggests they may or may not do it. But maybe she could give us a educated opinion, legal opinion on that topic.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, Representative Bunn, it is a mandate to the University of Minnesota Extension Service to adopt the policy, but the policy is to authorize that the participant fees be used to provide the educator. So it is a mandate to the University Extension, but it's not a mandate what the policy says. It says the policy has to be permissive.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and okay.
Any further questions? Representative Eastland.
I got that same section here kind of colored in with yellow, and to me it was kind of confusing. And where I was confused was, the if we're going to involve extension, the University of Minnesota, it almost, to me, sounds like they're authorizing and kind of imposing the fee. That's the way this thing sounds. And, I think what you're intending is they're authorizing local 4-H programs to be able to impose a fee if they want one. I think that's the confusion that I think maybe it says it right here, but it's not very clear, if you're not a reviser or somebody who really understands this stuff. So, I think that's... But I agree. I know 4-H programs in my county are being cut, and I know they're concerned. And if participants are willing to pay more to keep the programs going, I see nothing wrong with allowing that to occur. So I think this is a reasonable thing if it can be cleared up, so it's worded a little more clearly.
Representative Bunn, want to wrap up then? Or?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've addressed the issues, and we will check on that again. I believe as Ms. Dyson says, I think that this language does work, but if we can further tighten it so it's really clear, I'd be glad to do that as we move forward. And I appreciate this additional flexibility being added to our programs. And to represent Eastland's point, while this occurred at first time in Washington County, we are concerned with, particularly with next year, that we're going to see more of this. So we want to, as we're doing some mandate relief in education, we're doing some streamlining elsewhere, that we're trying to provide some more flexibility that as we get through these tough times, we won't lose important institutions, of which 4-H is one of those very important institutions. We want to make sure they survive this period of time.
Any further questions of the testifiers, of the representative? Anyone else that would like to speak for or against the bill? If not, Representative Sterner, renews his motion that House File 3392 be recommended to pass and return to the, as amended, to the return to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Hi, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Sure. Thank you. Members, I'd like to move House File 3591 be recommended to pass. And are we going to the general register, Mr. Chair?
We have to go through the government. We have to
go back.
The same way it came down.
Well,
right. We could try, but I don't. I think Representative Pawlowski would not appreciate that.
Okay. Oh, man.
So Representative Hornstein
last night, maybe.
recommends that it be passed and returned to the State and Local Government Operations
okay.
Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I have an A1 amendment that I'd like to incorporate.
Representative Hornstein moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment to put the bill in the form that he wants, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Explain your bill as amended.
I'm concerned about Representative Diskins wanting a little more government interference in the market here. But Mr. Chair, that's actually what this amendment was. First of all, this isn't simply enabling legislation. So this is enabling the city of Minneapolis to develop ordinances that in essence regulate the mobile food units. And this really comes because the ongoing interest in revitalizing downtown. We have the city in 2009 approved a downtown improvement district. And so this downtown improvement district has initiated cleanups, installation of signage, staffing to assist visitors to move around the area. They're working on ways to get people downtown to improve kind of the vibrancy of street life. We have Target Field coming in now, and if you've been to some of the other new stadiums, you'll see very active vendors selling food and other items. And this is just something what Representative Kahn thought we were trying to do the opposite, and so she approached me on the floor of the House and said, you know, we want downtown to be more like New York, not less like New York. And this will, you know, I think if you think about the vendors in New York City, this is, I think, one of the intents to make it a vibrant and energetic street-level experience. So the ordinance would permit the unit to operate for most of the summer. And I have a couple of people from the city that can testify further. Doug Kress from Councilmember Goodman's office is here as well. So that's the bill, and I seek your support.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Doug Kress. I'm with Councilmember Lisa Goodman's office, and we represent downtown Minneapolis. And we thank you for hearing this. As we were doing our research for this particular ordinance, we found that there was a state statute that was limiting us to 21 days in one spot for our food units. And we needed to expand that so that we could have them more frequently to increase our vibrancy in downtown. And that's what this bill actually helps us eliminate and allow us to increase the maximum days that would be allowed for the mobile food units. With that, I'll answer any questions for you.
So Mr. Chair, just to be clear in terms of what Mr. Kress said and what the amendment accomplished, the title of the bill, it's a little bit of a misnomer because we're not authorizing the city necessarily to restrict the duration, but simply, develop an ordinance to, expand. Have some more flexibility in terms of needing to expand it.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, I think that the reason Representative Kahn may have misinterpreted the bill is because it's capable of being misinterpreted. If the intention is to exceed the current statutory limit, Are you sure you don't want to say that rather than just leave open the possibility that a future city council could in fact restrict it to 2 days?
Representative, or Mr. Kress.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great question. We would like the opportunity to just extend it, and we felt that this would be a more appropriate language that we could use, saying that we could do an annual number of days on the units. If we wanted to reduce it, that would certainly be an opportunity, but we really are looking at extending it to make it more vibrant in our downtown. I don't see it going the other way.
Representative Hilton.
Well, a lot of, Mr. Chair, a lot of things happened that people didn't see coming.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Dyson. To Representative Hilty's point, as I look at your summary, Ms. Dyson, it would appear to me that the city could right now limit it to just 2 days. The thing that city can't do right now is agree to go more than 21 days than what Representative Hornstein is trying to do is to go more than 21 days. Am I correct, Ms. Dyson, that right now under current law the city could limit it to just 2 days?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, I believe you're correct. I mean, that was my first reaction, is that the statute defines it as no more than 21 days, but for definition of what a mobile food unit is. So I believe that a city could do it by ordinance to be lower than that, but can't go over it.
Representative Biskins. Okay. Any more questions of the bill? Anyone in the audience like to speak for or against the bill? Otherwise, Representative Hornstein renews his motion that House File 3591, as amended, be recommended to pass and return to the state. At the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Restriction as to the nature of the beverages served in mobile units.
Rather than the word restrict, it should have said shall be determined.
We'll represent Nelson.
I'd like to move House File 3359 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the State and Local Government Operations Committee.
Okay, thank you. So Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 3359 be recommended to pass and to return to the committee, State and Local Government. And then two-year bill, understand you might have an amendment as well.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment here. It's the A1 amendment. It should be in the packet. Basically, as it was pointed out, even though on line 1.8 it says diesel fuel and other energy sources, there was some confusion that because the county uses both diesel fuel and gasoline, unleaded fuel, they wanted to add that in just so there would be no confusion later on. And then the other part is making the quarterly report an annual report on line 2, page 11, and that's what the amendment does, and I'd like to move the amendment.
Okay, thank you. All those in favor of moving the amendment to the bill, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Great. Motion adopted, or amendment adopted.
And Mr. Chair.
Okay. The bill is amended.
The bill is amended. What it does is currently the state of Minnesota and the Metropolitan Council have the ability to do this forward pricing, buying gasoline and hedging on the market. And Hennepin County's been partnering with the state, as I've been told, to do this, but it's just they want the authority to be able to do it on their own, but this allows them to do a set of price and eliminate some of the fluctuations gas price. The amount of fuel that the county uses, a 10-cent increase in the gas price or the diesel fuel price can blow their budget real quick. And what they're by doing this, they can look out ahead, they can buy ahead on this pricing, and they can use this as a hedge, and it helps them secure their budgets, especially in these times when their budgets are being squeezed everywhere else. This allows them to have some control on their future budgets for gasoline and fuel purchases. And I have a testifier here from the county that they would like to speak also.
Okay, thanks. And could you state your name for the record, please?
Sure. My name is Maurice Giske, and I am director for Hennepin County Public Works Management Support. And as Representative Nelson outlined, Hennepin County is a large purchaser of petroleum-based fuels and natural gas. We buy about 800,000 gallons of fuel each year and another 550,000 decatherms of natural gas. We operate a fleet with over 1,100 units, including ambulances for Hennepin County Medical Center, squad cars for the Hennepin County Sheriff, heavy trucks and construction equipment for our transportation department, as well as passenger vehicles for other areas of the county. In addition, we operate the Hennepin County Energy Center, which provides steam and chilled water to the Hennepin County Medical Center Complex, the Hennepin County Government Center, and several other Hennepin County buildings in downtown Minneapolis. Over the past several years, we have seen significant volatility in pricing. For example, in July 2008, we saw a peak in natural gas prices of $12.57 a decatherm. And by May of 2009, gas prices had dropped down to $3.60 a decatherm and remained low through 2009. Currently, delivered prices on natural gas are running at about $5.63 a decatherm, so there's quite a bit of volatility in that market. On petroleum-based fuels, we saw prices peak, of course, in July 2008 at over $4 a gallon. Fortunately, in 2009, we started participating in the state fixed price fuel contract, and our average cost in 2009 was $2.05 a gallon. And in 2010, we were locked in at $2.45 per gallon. Even though the state fixed price contract provides certainty of pricing, it also has timing risk because we are locking the price for fuel at one point in time during the year versus being able to select when we lock our price. As we noted in 2008, the market price of commodities such as natural gas and fuels can be driven higher or lower by speculation about supplies and demand. In addition, events such as Hurricane Katrina in 2005 can cause price spikes due to supply disruptions and damaged infrastructure. In 2005, we saw natural gas prices peak at $12.03 in November of 2005 and remain high through March 2006. Financial hedging will provide Hennepin County with a tool to manage our budget and protect us from price spikes and speculation in the commodity markets. With this authority, we'll also be able to have the ability to lock pricing when market conditions appear favorable, such as in 2009. Thank you for considering our legislation. Stand for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Easton.
You kind of were explaining how you work into securing your market now by actually purchasing fuel at a fixed point in time.
Correct.
That's the way you're currently forward doing your forward pricing. Is that the way?
Actually, on fuel, we are not currently forward pricing because we do not have the ability to do so. Natural gas, we do. Operate a program with CenterPoint Energy where we are able to lock our price, but we don't have the flexibility that a financial hedging program would provide us.
Mr. Chair, I guess the concern that I have is that's a pretty low risk way of pricing into the future is actually the purchase at a fixed point in time. The commodity market is not a low risk. And I guess that's what I'm looking at here is what we're seeing in here is that you're going to buy or sell futures, basically what you're going to do. You can explain that to me, but that is an extremely high risk endeavor. And I guess my question is how do you plan to, minimize your risk and actually make this work any better? I think from a standpoint of a taxpayer, if we would see a huge spike in the market and we had made the wrong decision, we would be paying dearly. And I guess that's the question.
Sure. One of the things you do in a hedging program is that you dollar cost average. So, for example, you would not lock in your volume for a given month in the future in total. You would make small purchases over a period of time so as to avoid peaks or significant valleys. I mean, you'd want those, but that said, what you're trying to do, similar to purchasing stocks, is that you dollar cost average. So you would tend to smooth that curve and not lock yourself in. And so, for example, in the case of natural gas currently, what we do with the CenterPoint program is we may buy up to 10% of a given month's volume, okay, at a point in time, but generally not more than that. And so what you would do is you'd wait another month or weeks, what have you, to try to average into it. I agree there are risks associated with doing this. However, what we're trying to do is we're trying to provide budget certainty to the departments in Public Works, or excuse me, in Hennepin County, all of Hennepin County, so that when we set the budget, they aren't going to be surprised by significant increases like we saw with Hurricane Katrina, or the price spike that we saw in 2008 when we saw gas go to $4 a gallon. And so again, what we're trying to do is we're trying to provide a level of budget certainty that we can't currently accomplish with the tools we have. So this is just another tool that we may use in the future, and we're asking for authority to do that.
And I understand the what you're requesting here. I guess the thing that makes me a little nervous is selling specified amounts on the future market. I mean, I think to me that's to find yourself short in a bad situation is difficult. So I guess I'm just looking at this and saying, you know, I don't know if this is the route we want government to be speculating in the marketplace or going to the casino or whatever. Okay. I hate the point to you, Representative Pistons, but I mean, in a sense, this is kind of playing with some financial tools that have a very significantly larger risk factor, and I guess that's what concerns me a little bit, that we start going down this road. I'm not sure it's the route we want to go with taxpayers' money.
And if I could just clarify one point, we're not selling futures. What we're doing is we're locking in our price on the quantity that we expect to use within a 24-month window, and you know, the way the program works at Met Council on diesel fuel, for example, what they do is they liquidate those hedges just prior to expiration. And so what they're doing is they're making a commitment to buy it at a given price at in the future. And again, they're averaging into that to try to avoid these tremendous peaks. So we're not selling futures. We're not writing options. We're simply trying to lock in our price on the fuel and natural gas that we purchase.
Mr. Chair.
I represent Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Eastland. I on the State Government Finance Committee asked, as we're looking at everything that we can squeeze out of that budget, asked a few weeks ago whether we were doing everything we could at the state level to save money, and lo and behold, checked out what we're doing, and with folks at admin in actually read 16C.143, which is on the House Research memo, the summary, and as Mr. Miski already said, that the Met Council and the state are currently doing this, and the language almost exactly mirrors that. So I think we should keep tracking it and make sure, but we've had good success in limiting prices for the Met Council and the state.
Okay, Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Giske, if you're not selling anything, why do we have the language on line 13 that says an option to buy or sell the contract or financial instrument?
Mr. Gilski.
What we're doing is we're purchasing a futures contract, and in order to recognize the gain or loss at expiration or just prior to expiration, you do have to sell that contract. So we do have to buy it and sell it, because what you're doing is you're going into the marketplace and you're paying market prices for this commodity, and on the back side what you have is you have a financial instrument, in this case the option, which you're buying and selling just prior to expiration. So you do have to have the ability to purchase it and sell it just prior to expiration to receive the gain, so to speak, if there is a gain or recognize a loss. And that is part of the mechanism that we're talking about here.
And Mr. Chair, the language, as was pointed out, this mirrors the language that's in law for currently for Met Council and for the state of Minnesota.
Okay.
I think that's almost word for word.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Eastland?
Yeah, and I guess just kind of bouncing off of what Representative Hiltzy was talking about, I mean, that what you explain is maybe how you plan to do it, but that's not what the language says. If you saw a great opportunity to sell yourself short to make some money and buy it back later, that this language would allow you to do it, to take that risk. And so I guess that's what I'm saying is we're dealing with high risk stuff here, and if all of a sudden somebody starts to see this as a way to kind of manipulate money and make money and come out even better, we may be incenting people to take risks that are maybe not too wise. And so I guess that's just my concern. Whenever you're in the commodity market, in my opinion, you are at a high stakes poker game. And I think using the right rules, it works, but you can also use the wrong rules and try to gamble. And I just think that's what I'm concerned about here.
Yeah. One of the compensating controls, of course, in the statute or legislation is the investment committee that oversees the things that we do. The bill as drafted, as Representative Nelson indicated, is very close to Met Council's bill. So again, we weren't trying to create anything new here. We're just trying to obtain the same authority that the Met Council currently has.
Representative Biskins? No.
Waking me
up, Mr. Chair? No, that's intended to be. Okay, Representative Nelson, to your bill?
To my bill, like I said, this mirrors language, like I said earlier, that's currently in statute for the state of Minnesota and for the Met Council, and we're just trying to let Hennepin County, because the amount of fuel that they use, to be able to use this same tool to smooth out their budget. And I appreciate your support.
Thank you. Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 3359, as amended, be recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion adopted.
Minutes.
Yep, and then we got the minutes here. Okay.
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. You've carefully read through them and look.
Move.
Okay, all those in favor of the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Adopted and meeting
and
adjourned.
And Mr. Chair, we should be adjourned then, yeah.
Okay, we're adjourned. Okay.